decision that this war would influence these middle-class Russians, and especially in the regions where, you know, we know the villages where all the males are taken.
We have 10 seconds, Natalia.
So that would be it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Natalia Gomenyuk, who is the Ukrainian journalist based in Kyiv, founder of the Public Interest Journalism Lab, speaking to us today from Vienna. We'll link to her pieces in The Guardian and The Washington Post. And our deep condolences to the family of former Democracy Now! Engineer Frank Garfe, who has passed away at the age of 57. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, my Bertie Neguster, Messiah Rhodes, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Mary Conlin. We have two job openings at Democracy Now!, full-time job openings, one the people and culture manager, and the other as well is the assistant digital editor in social media. That does it for our show. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee meets quarterly on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is being held.
Can't get enough of The Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our entire first season, now streaming wherever you choose to listen to your podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe.
While you're at it, check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com so that we can keep you up to date on all the latest with The Ghost of Hollywood.
Claiming the word democracy for themselves. Who gave them the right to claim the word democracy? Democracy is our word. Who gave them the right to destroy the word human with their propagandic phrase, human rights? Human rights is our word. That's our phrase. They shouldn't sully these words in their mouths. Democracy. What democracy? What democracy? The democracy of money. The democracy of money. Buying elections. Bribing politicians. That's this democracy. How can you claim to be a democracy when you have people who are hungry in your country? How can you claim to be a democracy when you have people who are hungry in your country? How is that a democracy? What kind of perversion makes you say democracy when you allow people to be hungry, when you allow them to have no houses?
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for being here with us. I'm your guest host this hour, Nana Jumphy, filling in by invitation from my sister and comrade, the host of Sojourner Truth, Margaret Prescott. You just heard from Vijay Prashad, author, historian, executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, and the chief editor of the Left Word Books, speaking at Democracy Beyond the U.S. Empire, hosted by the People's Forum at the famed Riverside Church in Harlem, New York City. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onestad. Pro-Moscow officials say residents in all four occupied areas of Ukraine voted to join Russia. The Kremlin-orchestrated votes have been dismissed by Ukraine and its Western allies as illegitimate. The vote count in favor of becoming part of Russia was high, according to Russia-installed elections officials, 93% in the Zaporizhia region, 87% in southern Kherson, 98% in Luhansk. And the UN Security Council met Tuesday in New York to discuss the voting, with U.S. and Albania planning to introduce a resolution that says results will never be accepted and the four regions remain part of Ukraine. Eileen Alfandari has more.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the United Nations Security Council via video link. He denounced the Russian-administered referenda in Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. He spoke through a UN translator.
In front of the eyes of the whole world, Russia is conducting this so-called sham referenda on the occupied territory of Ukraine. People are forced to fill out some papers while being threatened by submachine guns.
Zelensky said the referenda and Russian attempts to annex Ukrainian territory rule out any talks with Moscow as long as Vladimir Putin remains president. He also called for Russia's complete isolation and tough new global sanctions. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield said she and Albania are teaming up on a resolution they will bring to the UN Security Council.
A resolution condemning the sham referenda, calling on member states not to recognize any altered status of Ukraine.
Russia's ambassador defended the vote as a long-awaited move to protect the right of Russian speakers in the four provinces.
The referendum were conducted exclusively transparently.
I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio. Over 194,000 Russian nationals have entered Kazakhstan, Georgia, and Finland in the week since President Vladimir Putin announced a partial mobilization of reservists to fight in Ukraine. Thousands fled to neighboring countries, most often by car, bicycle, or on foot. Hurricane Ian is barreling towards the Florida coast, gaining top winds of 155 miles per hour, just shy of a Category 5 hurricane, after battering the island of Cuba as a near Category 4, wiping out power across the entire island. Cuban officials evacuated 50,000 people. Florida officials ordered 2.5 million people to evacuate their homes along the southwest coast. Here's Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis.
When you have 5 to 10 feet of storm surge, that is not something that you want to be a part of. And Mother Nature is a very fearsome adversary.
President Joe Biden also declared an emergency.
My administration is on alert and in action to help the people of Florida. I've approved Florida's request for emergency assistance immediately upon receiving it from the governor when they received it. And I directed my team to surge federal assistance there before the storm hit. FEMA has already deployed 700 personnel to Florida, and the governor has activated 5,000 state National Guard with another 2,000 guards coming from other states.
Tampa and St. Petersburg could get their first direct hit by a major hurricane since 1921. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell warned Hurricane Ian will linger over Florida, causing even more damage.
Ian is moving toward western Florida at approximately 12 miles per hour. And at this time, we are expecting landfall somewhere between Fort Myers and Tampa. By the time it reaches the shores of Florida, the storm is going to slow down to approximately 5 miles per hour. And this is significant because what this means is that Floridians are going to experience the impacts from this storm for a very long time.
Criswell says officials are anticipating significant rainfall up to 25 inches in some isolated parts of the state. European Union's top diplomat says the bloc suspects damage to two underwater natural gas pipelines was sabotage and is warning of retaliation for any attack on Europe's energy networks. Energy companies are beefing up security. Seismologists say that explosions rattled the Baltic Sea before unusual leaks were discovered on two underwater natural gas pipelines running from Russia to Germany. The Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines are leaking but are not currently delivering fuel to Europe. They stand to decimate the ocean environment. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
And those were today's news headlines. It is an absolute joy to be joined by my brilliant and committed comrade, Manolo de los Santos. Manolo is the co-executive director of the People's Forum and a researcher at the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He co-edited, most recently, Viveremos, Venezuela versus Hybrid War, and Comrade of the Revolution, Selected Speeches of Fidel Castro. He is a co-coordinator of the People Summit for Democracy, most recently held here in Los Angeles in June. Welcome, comrade.
Thank you so much, Comrade Nana, for welcoming to your program this morning.
Thank you so much for joining us on Sojourner Truth. There is so much that is happening, and I want to see how much we can get in this time period. We started off the show with a rousing, provocative commentary by author and historian Vijay Prashad, speaking at the community meeting on democracy beyond U.S. empire that was held in Harlem just this past Saturday evening. I want to play another slightly longer clip just so that we can get into the meat of that conversation.
Yes, I think there's a lot to be talking about, and I'm glad that we can talk about it together.
Absolutely. We can play that clip.
200 years ago, the United States decided that it owns the Americas. Coup d'etat after coup d'etat after coup d'etat. From Guatemala to Brazil to Chile, Operation Condor. How many governments have you overthrown today, Joe? How many governments have you overthrown today, Joe? How many illegal, aggressive wars have you sanctioned, Joe? Did you vote to illegally bomb and destroy Iraq, Joe? Did you bomb illegally Libya and destroy that country, Joe? What are you doing today, Joe? Mediocre. Destroying the world and calling that democracy. That is not democracy. That is a perversion of the idea of democracy. The Monroe Doctrine, next year, 200 years. When is this country going to grow up? When is this country going to grow up? When is this country going to recognize that it actually is not a country on the hill? Give it up. You're just ordinary people. You're just people. You're just like the Mexicans. You're just like the Cubans. You're just like the Venezuelans. Relax. There's nothing special about the United States. Relax, guys. Relax. Relax. Take it easy. You'll have a lot less stress. Relax. You don't need a Monroe Doctrine. You don't need a global Monroe Doctrine. We don't need global NATO. We don't need U.S. warships in the South China Sea. We don't need that. We don't need any of that. We don't want war. We want peace. Let me tell you something strange. I know that the United States spends almost $1 trillion every year on war making. Almost $1 trillion. But do you know what the budget of the United Nations is? Do you know what the budget of the United Nations? United Nations is supposed to be an institution, a global institution to build peace. The United Nations annual budget, my friends, is $3 billion. $3 billion to build peace, $1 trillion just by the United States to produce war. You can't eat in this country. You can't find a house to live in this country. You can't go to school and study without going to debt in this country. But you can bomb any country in the world. Well done. Well done, guys. The greatest country in the world is the greatest country not because there's no hunger in it, but because you can destroy any other country in the world. Well done. Those are your values. The values of a country are not to be measured by its constitution. The values of a country are to be measured by its budget. And the United States spends half its budget trying to destroy the world. It spends half its money trying to destroy the world and then wags the finger and talks about democracy. Do you see how strange this looks from outside the United States? Do you see how weird this is? People look at this and think, who's this guy Biden? This is crazy. He's mediocre. He's wagging his finger. He's telling us about democracy. And right outside my window is a warship that's ready to destroy my family.
He was breaking it down, wasn't he? Tell us, comrade, what was the purpose, firstly, of that community forum where Vijay spoke so strongly there in Harlem, democracy beyond the U.S. empire?
Well, I think we were gathering for something that often gets denied to us who live inside the United States, which is the opportunity to dialogue directly with the leaders, with the activists, with the organizers, with the people of other countries who are actively trying to build a new model of development. We're trying to build new systems in which people can live with dignity. So it was a rare opportunity that we had to actually be in the same room with leaders from Cuba, from Venezuela, from Eritrea, and actively have the opportunity to exchange with them, to hear about how they've been building their own models of democracy, and to not chastise them, because we have no legitimacy or credibility to be talking to anyone else when it comes to the questions of democracy, knowing very well what it is like to live under the boot of the empire here inside the United States.
There was a lot of myth busting that was happening, which I really appreciated. As you indicated, we don't get that much opportunity, those of us living in the United States, to have direct dialogue and to hear nuance. And so, I know there's discussions, for example, about Cuba and what's really happening in Cuba. Share with us, first of all, who were the people that were present from Cuba that, were engaging in this conversation? Because it wasn't just any old anybody's. And then sort of a couple of the myths that that we have here in the United States around Cuba that you are really important to be busted.
Well, one of the amazing things is that we were honored to have the presence of the foreign ministers of Cuba and Venezuela, Comrade Bruno Rodriguez of Cuba, Comrade Carlos Faria of Venezuela. And it was moving to hear them speak about everything that's happening in their countries right now, despite the level of sanctions, the blockades, the hostility, the open aggression that they receive from the US government. I mean, this was Saturday night, the 24th of September, on the eve of one of the most historic and I would say groundbreaking elections, referendums to have ever taken place in Cuba, when, close to 7 million people came out to vote on something called the Code of Families, one of the most progressive legal projects ever, where Cuba is essentially redefining the concept of family and the rights of women and the rights of LGBTQ people and the rights of everyone to basically be able to form unions made out of love and be respected for doing so. It's probably the most progressive code of its kind in the world. And again, this was an election in which millions of people participated. That is in itself a busting of a major myth that somehow in Cuba there is no democracy, that there is no popular participation, But I think the bigger myth that was busted, or the bigger political point that was shared, was that for the Cubans and for the Venezuelans, the question of democracy is not one of going to vote every 4 years. It's not one of simply putting money on which candidate you think would do best for your interest. Democracy for the people of Cuba and Venezuela continues to be an experiment in terms of how can people actually lead the transformation of their own lives, and how can they do so collectively in a way that is beneficial to the community. That in itself was just an amazing experience hearing from them. And, you know, it's in stark contrast to what this country is living. I mean, as we speak, the rights of over half of the population, women, have been denied. Women are losing rights in this country by the day. Black people in this country are losing their rights by the day. Yet these are societies that are going, I guess, in the wrong direction, according to the U.S. Empire, because they're seeking to include more and more people in their project of development and benefit for society.
And I love how they describe and how you're describing what is happening as a project, right? Because with the United States and the way that the United States describes itself is usually, in a way that doesn't have any kind of sense of vulnerability. It's, you know, we're the ones, we're it, we're number one, we got it all together, we know how to do this thing, we define what things are, such as democracy and human rights. And really to hear, again, the nuanced conversations about what is happening in Cuba, what is happening in Venezuela, from people who are in high office in those governments, the foreign ministers themselves, was really compelling, I think. Let's talk a little bit about Venezuela, and then I want to get to the Cuba blockade, because, you know, Venezuela is a country that the United States has obviously also put into this effort of isolation, but in a different kind of way. I mean, going so far as to pretend that someone is a president that isn't a president, right? And kind of move in that way, apply sanctions, and really try to cripple Venezuela. Can you share some with us of what we learned about Venezuela and what's happening in Venezuela, particularly in light of or in spite of the sanctions that the U.S. has put up there?
Well, it's important to highlight the fact that, you know, Cuba has been facing a blockade for the last 60 years plus. And a variety of sanctions have been placed on Cuba during that period. Venezuela has received probably the same equivalent of sanctions or harsher in an even shorter period of time, meaning in the last 6 years. They have received a multitude of sanctions and unilateral coercive measures that essentially have left the country without 99% of its revenues. I'm going to say that again. Venezuela, due to U.S. sanctions and the U.S. blockade, has lost 99% of its revenue, meaning the resources that the Venezuelan state would normally be using to provide social programming, to meet the needs of its people, to import food, to import medicine, to provide, again, for the most basic necessities of the people, their hands have been cut off, in a sense. And to think that despite that, they have not renounced their project of building a people's democracy, in which, as I was reminded on Saturday night, since 1999, there have been 29 elections that have taken place in Venezuela. And when I say elections, I'm talking about elections in which there's been mass participation, high voter turnout, and where people are actively participating at all levels. Something which is, again, unseen, not just in the United States, but I would say it's unseen in many parts of the world. But they've introduced other elements of democracy, which I think we could learn from in the United States. The foreign minister spoke about how Venezuelan democracy includes, for example, the right to reparations, which is a hot topic and debate across the global north. But here's this poor country, reduced in its resources, still taking on the question of reparations as a historic necessity towards Afro descendants in Venezuela. They talked about democracy in the light of having access to healthcare, and how even though they've been, again, without many resources, they have prioritized providing healthcare to those who need it the most without charging a cent. To me, these are highlights of what democracy could look like in the United States if the interests of the ruling class, of the elites in this country, weren't the dominating ones. What it would look like if poorer and working people, if Black people and women could actually run this society for the benefit of all.
It was really interesting, particularly the question of reparations, surprising that it came up, not just because of the fact that there has been this reduction in the economic resources of Venezuela, but because there's so often a conversation when we talk about countries in South America, countries in Central America, countries in the Caribbean that are Spanish speaking in particular, so much of a conversation of the invisibilization of Black folks. And, you know, they talked about that as well, both with Cuba and Venezuela, the efforts to really squarely address racism and squarely address the conditions that African descendants in those countries are in. And so that reparations question, very, very interesting. I have a question about the blockade as well. So as you raised this blockade against Cuba, 50 years old, this conversation that was had with the foreign minister of Cuba and the foreign minister of Venezuela had as its backdrop and maybe foredrop the United Nations General Assembly, which was also in session that same week, last week. And there were world leaders from across the planet that were there. It's their time to get together and often to lift their voices about issues that they're concerned about. And leader after leader after leader in their presentation before the entire General Assembly condemned the U.S. blockade of Cuba. Let's play that clip, please.
South Africa calls for an end to the embargo against Cuba.
We again join the overwhelming majority of members of the international community in reiterating Guyana's rejection of the sanctions imposed on the Republic of Cuba.
We entreat the United States to end the long-standing embargo imposed on Cuba.
Otra muestra clara de la aplicación de medidas unilaterales es el inhumano y criminal bloqueo comercial y financiero contra Cuba.
Argentina se suma al reclamo de los pueblos de Cuba y Venezuela para que se levanten los bloqueos que esas naciones padecen.
Pregonamos el retorno al respeto a la autodeterminación de los pueblos, rechazando el infame y brutal bloqueo al pueblo de la hermana República de Cuba.
Namibia reiterates its long-standing call for the lifting of the unjust embargo against Cuba.
I call once again for the total lifting of the embargo that has affected the government and the people of Cuba.
El gobierno de los Estados Unidos continúa ignorando la demanda casi unánime de ustedes para que cese su política ilegal y cruel contra Cuba.
Let's talk about that. Why do you think the majority of countries at the United Nations consistently call for the end of the U.S. blockade of Cuba?
Well, firstly, because no one else in the world thinks Cuba is a threat or is a danger. No one else in the world sees Cuba as an enemy. On the contrary, when you look around the world, when you ask not just leaders of states or governments around the world, but when you ask people around the world, the usual first reference they have when you ask them about Cuba is doctors or teachers or aid. The people of the world identify Cuba as being a country that is generous in its solidarity with the peoples of the third world. The fact that Cuba has essentially sent medical brigades possibly to all corners of the third world, to the places where doctors often don't go, the Cubans will often go. And that story can be heard from Nepal, it can be heard in South Africa, it can be heard in Ghana, it can be heard all over the third world. And I think that's why ultimately it's a resounding call that the world makes. And I would add that it's the 30th year in which the Cubans will introduce a resolution against the blockade. And for 30 years, the majority of the world, in the last few years, almost a unanimous vote. Only two countries opposed this resolution to end the U.S. blockade on Cuba, being the United States and Israel. Imagine that this is going to be the 30th year in which this resolution is proposed. And again, we suspect that, again, only the United States and Israel will be the countries to vote against it.
Just amazing. And it just lets you know that this conversation about democracy is really a joke when it comes out of the United States and what it expects, not just for our people here that are living within the United States, but even within those larger bodies that represent all of our countries. We have the clip lined up. I think it's important for folks to be able to hear. Again, these are leaders from all over the world, from the continent of Africa, the Caribbean, Asia, South America, Central America, speaking up and out. I believe we even have some countries from Europe in this clip, speaking up and out against the U.S. blockade of Cuba. Let's get that clip. That's just a smidgen, just a sample, a small taste of the leader after leader after leader speaking up against the U.S. blockade of Cuba, describing it as illegal, describing it as criminal in as many languages as you can imagine. Comrade, how do people contact you if they want to join in the people's effort to have democracy beyond U.S. empire and to support the end of the blockade and sanctions against Cuba and Venezuela?
Well, I encourage everyone to take a look at our social media, the social media of the People's Forum, as well as our website. Right now, in fact, we have launched a major fundraising campaign to support the people of Cuba in their recovery from the most recent Hurricane Ian that has just pummeled through Cuba, has affected greatly the housing situation and also the energy grid in the country. But we are committing to support and stand by the Cuban people. And we have a fundraiser. You can look at it at peoplesforum.org/fundraiser. And every donation, every cent that is donated is going to go to provide roofing material, to provide other supplies that the Cuban people urgently need and that the U.S. blockade denies them.
Thank you so, so very much again. Really appreciate you. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you so much, comrade.
We'll be back to dive into the crisis in Puerto Rico after this short station break. This is not a jump feed, today's guest host of Sojourner Truth. And we are now turning to the crisis in Puerto Rico, where a hurricane, Hurricane Ian, has devastated the population and the island there. Let's go to a clip.
The majority of us still don't have power, and there are people dying. A 72-year-old man and his 93-year-old mother died after their house caught fire from candles they were using for lights. In another town, a man died after his generator exploded. And another man and his dog died after breathing in the gases from his generator. I haven't made videos about these cases because they're truly heartbreaking and unnecessary, but it is a crisis situation. There are hospitals and healthcare facilities that are still running on generators. And people are struggling to find fuel for their generators, and we don't know when all of Puerto Rico will have power again. We're tired and we're worried.
Francisco Andres Santiago Cintron is the coordinator of Acción Independista, a member of Vamos, Concertación Guidiana, and the community coordinator of the Red Comunitaria Respuesta, which groups more than 13 communities around Puerto Rico on the principle of solidarity and sovereignty. He is also executive editor of the Puerto Rican progressive journal Critica, Cuaderno de Discusión Política. Greetings and welcome, Francisco.
Greetings. Thank you for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Really concerned about what is happening in Puerto Rico. I was just there this last summer, still seeing the after effects even of Maria and hurricanes before, and can't imagine what is going on in the country now. If you could please just start by giving us a picture. We heard that clip from Bianca Graulau, who is currently an independent broadcast journalist based in Puerto Rico, but wanting to hear from you, what is the situation there?
The situation here is basically a compounded reality of human crisis that were really never completely resolved with previous crises. Just to give you a general reality, you know, even before the Hurricane Maria in 2017, we have an economic depression since 2005 that came after was a crisis of debt, and after that, what we have had are neoliberal policies. Now, why do I go all the way back there to talk about what's happening now? And it's because the reality is that, you know, the reality of the Caribbean has always been a reality of knowing that natural disasters on one moment or another would come. No, hurricanes have always been part of our reality as the Caribbean. Notwithstanding, the human crisis that comes afterwards does not have necessarily have to have a correlation with that natural disaster, but with the ability of governments to respond to that reality, you know? And those neoliberal policies that happened even before Maria, compounded with the reality of colonialism and the reality of poverty that has always been here in Puerto Rico, have led to what we have now, which is just a continuation of the human crisis that we had even before. In terms of real numbers, no, we have had right now at least 21 confirmed deaths related to the human crisis that occurred after Hurricane Fiona, which is the last hurricane that came. And we've had right now at least 30 to 40% of the population in Puerto Rico without energy. Well, and this is important also because in the statistically wise, they are right now, the government is saying that they have actually done a great job, you know, in that process. But in the streets, what we see is something very different. In as much, there's also one element that has to be talked about in this new emergency, and it's that in the last year, the Puerto Rican Power Authority was largely privatized, except for the generation of electricity. Commercial and distribution of electricity were privatized and were passed to a company now known as LUMA, L-U-M-A. And in this last year, Puerto Ricans have seen constant blackouts in different sectors of the island, which had led to economic stress even before the passing of Hurricane Fiona. And so with the passing of Hurricane Fiona, what we've had is just a complete intensification of the stresses that people live day by day. No?
Yeah, no, I'm just, as you're talking, I'm thinking, when I was in law school, I had a friend who was from the U.S. Virgin Islands, and we used to fight, and I'm talking about fight, almost roll down the hallways, about the benefit of being a colony of the U.S., because as a person from Ghana, which is not a colony of the U.S., but still deals with neoliberal policies imposed by the World Bank, IMF, et cetera, I was looking at what was happening in the Virgin Islands with infrastructure, looking at what's happening in Puerto Rico with infrastructure, looking at what was happening at the time, is it the 90s, and infrastructure in Ghana. And I was saying, hey, I don't see where you're getting a benefit. And in fact, at least we're independent. Talk about that, because so much of what needs to happen to address the human crisis, as you've described, which is something different than the conversation about climate crisis, et cetera, in a way. But the human crisis, you know, hands seem to be tied. The people I know, and I want to ask you about what they're doing on the ground, but, you know, it seems that the colonial nature of Puerto Rico is definitely getting in the way.
It undoubtedly is. And I'll give you two examples. And when we talk about the reality here on the ground, I might say that we have two Puerto Ricos. No, and depending who you ask, you will have a whole different story. No, you have the rich Puerto Rico, no, the Puerto Rico that practices in a way gentrification and settler colonialism in at least in the last few years in a more intense way. And I'll give you an example. Right now, for example, in Puerto Rico, we have a law that's called Law Number 60. It was before that it was called Law Number 20 and 22. And what that law does is that any person that comes from outside. No, normally it was normally catered to, and it's still catered to U.S. citizens, no, rich U.S. citizens in mainland United States that come to Puerto Rico and can prove that they live at least 6 months in Puerto Rico will have a tax deduction where they will have to pay 0% of their winnings in that year in Puerto Rico, no. And not only that, but the same law establishes that if there is an emergency like the one we have been living in Puerto Rico, a hurricane, they can just leave the country for at least 1, 2, 3 months, and that will still count as the 6 months necessary for living here. No, that's an example. Another example is that in that process of gentrification, and I can tell you, for example, the percents of generation of electric generation right now. At least 90% of all electrifications have happened in the north and in the metropolitan area of Puerto Rico, no, the capital and its nearby towns and suburbs. But when you look at the southwest of Puerto Rico, from Ponce to Mayagüez in the coast, that actually, according to the last census, is the most poverty-stricken area of the country. Right now, no more than 50% of that part of the country has electricity. So we're looking at structural realities that perpetrate not only poverty, but colonialism, no? And there is broad support by both the current government in Puerto Rico and the U.S. government in perpetuating that reality. And that is part of the reset that we see that humanitarian crisis occurring right now. And to answer the question, I would also fight with that person, U.S. Virgin Islands, because I'm also of the posture that, you know, the colonial relationship, be it with the U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, or any of the Caribbean islands still under a colonial relationship, has only profound negative effects in the lives of the people that live it.
Oh, that's an important interruption, please. That's not a problem, because I think it's important for people to hear that. Talk about, in the next couple of minutes as we close out this section, talk about what the people are doing. Because whenever we have these humanitarian crises, the people themselves, with a capital P, pull together to get stuff done in support of each other. And let us know what people can do here on the mainland if they want to support Puerto Ricans.
What we're doing right now, at least in the street, and I think that was a big lesson after Hurricane Maria, there's an important element, and is that with the neoliberal, before Hurricane Maria in 2016, Hurricane Maria was in 2017, because of the debt crisis, the Obama government with the Puerto Rican government passed a law that's called PROMESA law, which made it possible for the Puerto Rican government to go to default. And as you know, with the IMF, what that means is that they will condone part of the debt, but you have to have certain or broad neoliberal policies. And what that meant for Puerto Rico was broad budget cuts for the different agencies, no, that have as their reasons to exist services for the population, no, for human rights, for the preservation of human rights. And so what we've had in that process is that even if those agencies exist, they exist nominally. They don't really have the capacity to carry out their functions because they don't have the budget to do so. And because of that reality, and when 2017 happened, that was under Trump, what we've had afterwards in Maria was a total collapse of government services. And so in that process, what happened was the communities realized what we have always known, no, but it just came back again from under the covers, and is that we have only ourselves in a certain way. And obviously the solidarity of people around the world, no, that when we've always counted on that, and I think that's something that we've always have to acknowledge, but in the ground, we've had ourselves in the capacity of us to organize and really look out after ourselves. And so that was the big lesson in Maria. Afterwards, we had earthquakes in the south, the part that right now is not energized. And after that, we have the pandemic, and now we have this hurricane. And what I want to say with this is that what is happening right now in the ground is that those infrastructure, communal infrastructure that were created after Maria or that existed before Maria are right now just giving, no, and constructing community power to just confront the crisis. And so my recommendation is just to get in contact with those organizations and directly support in any way that they ask, you know, specifically in those initiatives.
Thank you so very much. How do people reach you if they want to be in contact with you?
You could reach me at my email. It's Francisco at Vamos, that's VAMOS.org. And you can also reach me in Facebook, Francisco Santiago Cintron. And in that initiative is where we're canalizing, you know, much of the solidarity that's coming, you know, in support of the communities that we work with.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. We're sending positive energy. Thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you for this space and a lot of solidarity from our we're here too.
Thank you. If you're on Facebook, you can look for Sojourner Truth and give them a like. We're also on SoundCloud. Look for us there, Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. On Twitter and Instagram, follow our handle at So True Radio and visit our website for additional content at sotrueradio.org.
My back is strong. Strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah.
Aunt Sarah, this is the way they see us. This is the way they see us. Aunt Sarah, ready to take the pain again and again. That was For Women by the incomparable Nina Simone. This is Nana Jumphy, guest hosting for Margaret Prescott on Sojourner Truth. Pleased to be joined now by Tiffany Flowers. Tiffany Flowers is an organizer with a Day Without Us campaign, a longtime local and national abolitionist, activist, and organizer, as well as the DJ. You know, I got to get some music in for you, who has helped unionize Bernie Sanders staff, create and launch the Breathe Act with Movement for Black Lives, and again is organizing Day Without Us, a Black radical womanist-led strike. Welcome, Tiffany.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me, Nana. Appreciate being here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tell us, who is the us in the Day Without Us, and why are we taking off that day?
I appreciate that question right out the gate. You know, the us is everybody who understands exactly what is happening right now. The us is all of the people who are sick and tired of being sick and tired. The us is the people who believe that we have a right to clean air, to fresh water, a reasonable expectation to free, to clean and reasonably priced housing. Those of us who have who feel as though denying 50% of the population their humanity and bodily autonomy is completely unacceptable. Those of us who see what this Supreme Court, this completely, completely illegitimate court is doing and will continue to try to do to take and take from us. Those who are sick and tired of the systems that continue to rob us and, as the kids say, play in our face. We're sick and tired and we're done and we're doing something about it.
And so this is happening September 30th. You got time? We got time, folks, to get ourselves organized. And what exactly is going on? I know it's not just one day,
technically, but what, give us a sense of what's happening with this day without us.
Absolutely. So I'd first like to highlight the significance of the day, if that's all right. On Friday, September 30th, is actually the 46th anniversary of the Hyde Amendment, which I don't know if everybody knows, but it actually means that if you are a pregnant person and you are seeking an abortion, even if it means that you would lose your life and you are someone who is on government-assisted health care, you could not use that health care, again, even if it meant saving your life. And for 46 years, that's been a law, and it's an amendment that our opposition uses to sneak into other bills to try to stop our progress. And so we thought it was important to do some education, first and foremost, and second of all, to do that education through the framework of reproductive justice, which I'm sure folks know is a phrase that was coined and a framework that was coined by 12 Black women in the 90s. And that also, again, speaks to the idea that if we're to live in a society where all of us are free, that means we get to choose when, how, and if we start families and what that would mean for their future. So we're going to do some teach-ins. A little bit untraditional in that it won't just be lecture style. There'll be a lot of conversations. There'll be a lot of organizations that work across movements in conversation, talking about how all of our work is connected. And much like everything we talked about earlier today, how we've got to stick together, because the systems that want our opposition and the systems that want to work against us are certainly coordinated. So there's online education and offline activations across America on Friday.
Excellent. So before I get you to tell us where or some of the places where people can plug in across the country, can you share with us what other organizations are engaged in this? Because I know this is like a coalition of groups, at least, that are spreading the word and sharing information. I got the information as shared by my sister Judith, ED over at Advancement Project, and just trying, you know, so I know that they're like cheerleading. Who else is on board here?
Sure. Shout out to Judy at Advancement Project. We have the Alliance for Youth Action. We have Ben and Jerry's. We have Black Feminist Future. We have Black Feminist Project, which is up in the Bronx, Tanya Fields and the Alice Fields Community Center. We have Black Voters Matter. We have CPD Action, Color of Change, local groups like a abolitionist-led Black woman group in D.C. called Harriet's Wildest Dreams, Moms Rising, the Movement for Black Lives. The list goes on and on. Survivors Know, the Frontline, the Unitarian Universalist Association, as well as Until Freedom D.C. So the grouping that we have here is for a reason, again, that we want to prove and demonstrate and live how our movements have to, how we are truly one movement. We're one ecosystem. And Judy's work in the Advancement Project and helping secure the ballot and making sure people can vote is as important as the work of Movement for Black Lives. It's integral to that work as the March for Our Lives. And so we're going to be in conversation and talking about how all of our work supports each other and helps us move that dial that much closer to liberation and the most urgent problem right now, which is reproductive freedom.
Where across the country, if people are interested, and again, I'm not asking you to name every place because I know it's a lot of places, but giving folks a sense of where, because this is a show that people hear across the country, where are places that there are going to be some activations? And then if someone is interested in saying like, okay, I'm here, you know, I want to be a part of this in person, where do they plug in?
Sure. There's an activation here in New York City. There's a one in Worcester, Massachusetts, Chicago, Los Angeles. I'm unfortunately, because of what's happening right now with the hurricane, Miami is unlikely. But Atlanta, there will be a pop-up. North Carolina, there's a pop-up. So if people want to plug in, please, please go to our website, daywithoutus.com. And that's also where the programming will be. It will start at 12 p.m. on Friday, and it will go straight through until 4 o'clock with different, like I said, panels, talks, information directly from the ground, and organizers and organizational leaders who are doing this really important work.
And then for those folks who are not, you know, in places where there are actual activations, number one, is there capacity or the ability to connect up with you all and try to get an activation together of some sort? And then secondly, if you can only do it virtually, what kinds of things can people expect in the virtual programming?
Yes, you can still, it's not too late. You can still go onto our website, again, daywithoutus.com. And we have a very easy to navigate site. And there's a drop down box for pop-ups. And all you have to do is fill out that form. There's a human being on the other side of that form by the name of Angela Peoples. And she is the pop-ups director, and she will get back in touch with you. It's really an expansive view of what pop-ups could be. So don't feel overwhelmed. We have some people that are just going to go out and register people to vote. We have other people who are going to be doing some community care and mutual aid. We have some people who are going to take advantage of the very generous offer by our partner Ben and Jerry's to give ice cream to local organizers who are hosting pop-ups, to have an ice cream social and have some conversations and tabling about things happening in the community. So please go to our website, daywithoutus.com, click that pop-up drop-down box, send us a fill out the form real quick, and we can get back to you before Friday. It's certainly not too late. And in terms of what you can expect with the programming, you can expect a very, very, very well thought out and loving presentation of the information that's going on across movements right now. You will see Judy, and you will see Cliff Albright and Miss Latasha Brown from the Advancement Project and Black Voters Matter, giving us a history and a framework and talking about how we got to this moment right now and everything that's truly at stake in terms of securing the ballot, being able to vote safely and securely, and what that means or doesn't mean for our future. You'll hear from youth organizers around how they're organizing around gun violence and reproductive rights and community safety and reproductive rights. You'll hear from, we have a really exciting segment called People in Your Neighborhood. And here we're gonna have lots and lots of quick but thoughtful conversations with people just like us who are doing this work every single day and letting folks know easy, easy ways to tap into the work.
Well, you all put out a lot of different possibilities, a lot of ways that people can get connected and can get involved. And so as we close, I want to go back to what I started with, talking about A Day Without Us as a Black radical womanist-led strike. What does that mean? Because I think sometimes when we talk about something being Black, that's why I wanted to know who the us was, so that people understand the expansiveness. But there is a tradition that this is rooted in that comes from Black radical womanist praxis. So share with us briefly, what does that mean?
Yeah, I think it's, thank you for noting that. And just using that phrase and that terminology is exactly what this day is about. Trying for folks to hear a phrase like that and be like, what does that mean? And for us to say, it really means exactly what you just said. We are Black women, we are organizers, and oftentimes Black women are organizers and don't even know it, right? Who are the people that are collecting money in the church? Who are the people that are making sure people are safe, our elderly and sick are safe when storms and different disasters happen? Who are the people that are making sure people are getting in the car and going to vote and the kids are fed and the, you know, all of this work that we take on, this invisibilized work that we do in service of our society, in service of our families, and most importantly, in service of our communities, because we believe in a brighter future and what the actual possibility is. And so being Black women, seeing this fight and knowing, again, giving honor, so much honor to the 12 Black women who came before us, who saw that reproductive justice is not about women and vaginas and abortion, but truly, truly about what the landscape looks for our community. So it's really about picking up that mantle, sharing that information with our folks, and making sure people are firmly, firmly planted and grounded in the moment and what the possibilities are.
Oh, we got to run or I would keep going. Please give that website again. And thank you so very much, Tiffany, for joining us.
Thank you so much. daywithoutus.com. Click on the pop-ups and come see us. We can put something together.
Excellent. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
We are out of time. Gosh, always happens. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator for today, Gary Baca, and assistant producer, Alicia Vargas. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! This is your guest, host, Nana Jumpy.
Help me now, baby. Please. You gotta help me. Cause I need somebody. I need you right now. Come on in. Let me know that you need me, dude. Don't make me cry, baby. 7 times a day. Lord have mercy. I'm like a lost sheep. You know I'm gonna stay. Please let your love fall upon me, baby.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, October 5th for Dead Moon Night.
A 4-hour extravaganza celebrating
the 2017 event when 11